Not for the first time and not for the last, I will begin this program by saying this. Political news got all the glory this week. The economic news is what's going to last. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday, the very first day of March 2019. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This has been, an interesting economic week, I guess. We got some Fed stuff, we got some trade stuff, we got some politics stuff as well. Also, we've got Gina Smilek. She's from Bloomberg. Dion Rabon is at Axios. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
What's up, Kai?
Oh, you know, same old, Friday afternoon. So look, I am going to play you two a piece of tape that we had on this program on Monday, and then we're going to talk about it. You ready?
Ready.
Okay. Here we go.
Do you think the president has a grasp of macroeconomic policy?
No, I do not.
So that was me, obviously, and one Janet Yellen in her office at Brookings. We spoke last week. We aired it this Monday. Here's, Dion, my question for you. Were you surprised that she said it out loud?
You know what? I like how Dr. Janet Yellen is really letting Jelly from BK step out to the forefront and let you know what's really good.
She's from Brooklyn.
Exactly. Jelly from BK is not playing around. And you know what? This is the thing. Here's the thing that so many economists, so many economic strategists, so many market strategists have told me over time. It's clear that the president doesn't understand how macroeconomic policy or economic policy or even monetary policy. I don't think he understands how fiscal policy works. And for her to step out and say it, I think was really great because it's been this sort of unspoken secret. And, you know, everyone in the president's cabinet, everyone on you know, on Capitol Hill seems to say these things. And I love that Janet Yellen was just willing to step out and say, no, he doesn't.
So, Gina, I'm going to play one more piece of tape from you. This is from the following day. It's a hearing on Capitol Hill. You may actually well have been there. I don't know. The first voice you're going to hear is Sherrod Brown, Democratic senator of Ohio, and then the current Fed chair, Jay Powell. Here you go.
Thank you. Thank you again for being here, Chairman Powell. Yesterday, your predecessor, Janet Yellen, said she doesn't think President Trump has a grasp of macroeconomic policy. Is she right?
I won't have any comment on that for you, Senator.
All right. I guess I'm not surprised.
Of course he was going to say that, Gina. But to Dion's point about saying it out loud, how much does it matter?
Yes, I think it's an interesting question. Certainly, I was really surprised to read that in your interview transcript when it came out. I have to be totally honest, just because.
So was I. So was I that she said it. I mean, in all honesty, so was I.
Jelly from BK.
Yeah, well, because they have been so careful about avoiding sort of getting into the political fray, you know, avoiding being critical in an outright way of the Trump administration. And there's a good reason for that. You know, when they criticize politicians, they open themselves up to criticism. And I think we should be clear, Janet Yellen is no longer at the Fed, but that doesn't mean she has no influence at the Fed. She's in regular communication with Jay Powell. She said that in the interview you had with her. And so I think it's surprising to me that she would sort of open up this conversation in such a sort of forthright right way.
Dion, to Jay Powell's testimony, since he's the guy with the job now, was up on the Hill twice this week, once in the House, once in the Senate, basically said, everything's all right. You know, yes, we have a little too much debt. And, you know, I'm a little worried about the economy running out of gas sometime. But basically, everything's fine, right?
Yeah, that's what he said. And I was having a conversation today with a macroeconomist. And the interesting thing that he also said in his testimony that I really thought didn't get enough play was talking about stopping the balance sheet runoff. Essentially, what he's saying is the Fed is going to continue to buy hundreds of billions of dollars of bonds in perpetuity with no end in sight. The Fed has historically held about $1 or 2 trillion on its balance sheet. It's got more than double that right now. And the idea was if we're running this healthy economy where things are functioning as they're supposed to, where people have jobs, unemployment's low, all these macroeconomic indicators are pointing up, that the Fed should be able to stop stimulating the economy by buying all these bonds. And Powell saying, no, you know, we think we're probably going to stop doing that. This thing that was supposed to be on automatic pilot, as he said, for the rest of the year, really says that, wow, this economy can't stand on its own. And that's something I think people should pay more attention to.
All right, so Gina, with the caveat that you two are you know, Fed aficionados, I'm going to turn us to trade here for a second, right? Because there were China talks last week. Robert Lighthizer was on Capitol Hill this week saying, you will see how the deal goes. It's going to be really hard. Your thoughts on perhaps where or when this ends?
Yeah, so I think there's a really interesting question here, because what Robert Lighthizer said was a little bit at odds with what President Trump had previously said. You know, Trump was pretty declarative that they were making progress, and then Lighthizer got up and had a lot of ifs, as my boss put it.
Sure.
And so my colleague Jenny Leonard reported that the U.S. is actually eyeing potentially a Xi-Trump summit, as Xi from being from China, Trump summit, potentially as soon as mid-March. So actually a pretty accelerated timeline there. Now that is just, you know, an anonymous source, and we're not sure how realistic that is as a timeline. But it does seem like there is still some impetus from the White House to get something done on this fairly soon.
Well, let me ask you both, actually, and Dion, you get to go first. The same question I asked last Friday, which was, has the president put himself in a corner where he now has to make a deal? Excuse me, has to make a deal because there will be, and people are starting to feel, the macroeconomic impact.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes. Like, everyone on the market that I've talked to, and not just recently, going back 6 months, 12 months, really since he got elected, has expected that there's going to be a deal with China. We're going to have some marginal changes, a lot like what happened with NAFTA, and we're going to get a deal. The president's going to call it the best ever. Everyone goes home for dinner. that's been the expectation for the market for a long time, and everything else really has just been noise, which is why you haven't seen a lot of market moves during this whole process.
Right. Gina, 30 seconds. Same question to you. Has the president put himself in a corner here?
So I'm going to agree that yes is the short answer. I would add that the caveat to
okay,
that.
Okay, now you got 26 seconds. Go.
I would add that the caveat to that at this moment is that a lot of the things that were making that a really essential move that Trump had to make, you know, a lot of the cracks in the data have seemed to sort of play out in not such a bad way in the last couple of weeks. You know, the stock market really rebounded thanks to the Fed. I think we've seen, you know, fourth quarter GDP numbers came in looking pretty solid. You know, the year over year GDP was really good in the fourth quarter. And so I think those things do take some of the pressure off, although clearly not all of it. And I think there is still this expectation, certainly baked into markets, that there is going to be some kind of an agreement here.
We will get to the consumer side of this a little later in the program with Mitchell Hartman. That was the host's prerogative there, right? Throwing out one last item. Gina Smiley from Bloomberg and Dion Rabowan from Axios. Thanks, you two.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. Wall Street on this Friday. Pretty good day, all in all. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We direct your attention now to Securities and Exchange Commission Form S-1, a registration statement under the Securities Act of 1933, filed by Lyft Incorporated, San Francisco, California, USA, on this date. Or, in plain English, at long last, we have the first big ride-sharing company initial public offering, and it is not, as it happens, Uber. Marketplace's Jack Stewart takes a look at what this filing by Lyft tells us.
Lyft launched in 2012. In the filing today, the founders wrote, "In those early days, we were told we were crazy to think people would ride in each other's personal vehicles. Now, they're looking to raise $100 million by going public and also maintain control with super voting shares." Kathleen Smith at Renaissance Capital has been looking at the prospectus.
Our feeling is the numbers, certainly the top line numbers, look pretty good.
The filing shows Lyft lost nearly $1 billion in 2018, but its revenue was about $2.2 billion and its market share is growing. Its biggest investor is Japanese e-commerce company Rakuten, which owns 13%. General Motors and Alphabet, which is the parent of self-driving car company Waymo, both have smaller stakes and both have a specific interest in the transportation data that Lyft collects. Susan Shaheen is at the Transportation Sustainability Research Center at UC Berkeley.
Companies like Lyft and others are moving into the space of mobility services.
Investors are betting those services like bikes, scooters, and a platform for sharing cars could help prepare for any decline in private vehicle sales. Lyft has beaten its bigger ride-hail rival, Uber, to an IPO, but there's no big advantage to that, says Barrett Daniels at Deloitte & Touche.
I think people may be reading too much into this in that there's a technical component, when maybe it's just a friendly competition to see who can get out first.
Lyft did score a good stock symbol on the NASDAQ, LYFT. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Don't underestimate a good ticker, by the way. One does wonder who has UBER. From the retail world, this item, Gap is going to spin off its successful budget brand Old Navy into a separate company, a testament not just to Old Navy's growth, but also to Gap's waning grip on the American retail market. This breakup is also going to force some decisions, including what to do with one very valuable asset, customer data. And as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, that could be tricky.
Gap and Old Navy have yet to figure out just how they will deal with the data collected on customers over the years. Here's Gap CEO Art Peck speaking to investors yesterday.
We do have customer overlap, and that's something that we're going to manage. You know, the file will be a property, we think, of both companies. That's something we need to sort out.
Because data on customers is one of the most important assets a company has. Credit card numbers, ages, addresses, what we return, what we look at on websites, but don't buy. Trini Ahmed is with the Center for Customer Insights at Yale.
And especially for a company that has multiple brands, to be able to, you know, leverage the data across the brands is very important.
And even after the companies decide how or if they'll split up the data, moving around information gathered over decades isn't simple, says Jenny Gebhardt with the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
We kind of picture sometimes that there's a folder somewhere that has my name on it, and you know it has my address, my credit card information, and everything I've ever bought and clicked on. That could be the case.
But it isn't. Even at one company, all kinds of customer data are stored in all kinds of places. And sometimes when there's an attempt to sort through all that information, organize it, and separate it,
making sure all your information goes over to Gap or all of it goes over to Old Navy or some goes to one place or the other, it very much is, here we have all these data points on a shelf and it's all stable, but indeed when we try to move them, that's when the furniture starts to fall apart.
Gap, which declined to comment for the story, will have to sort all this out soon. The company is hoping the split will be completed next year. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Brexit Month. The United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland is officially supposed to leave the European Union on the 29th March, officially being the operative word there because, well, that's what the vote was 2.5-something years ago now, right? Prime Minister Theresa May has been steadfast that Brexit is a-coming on the 29th, come what may. But she was forced to make a major concession to the Remainers in her cabinet this week that could, because at this point, who knows with this thing, but it could wind up postponing the UK's departure, much to the exasperation of the Brexiteers, as they're known. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been meeting with some of the Brexit bulls.
This company, Clevedon Fasteners, makes rivets, 30 million of them a month. You could say the boss, Steve Hardiman, is in the business of getting down to brass tacks.
We make very basic sort of products. We take wire and we hit it very hard and we make fasteners of various kinds.
And he's equally blunt about his reasons for supporting Brexit.
We have got a fantastic future on our own. I've got an enormous amount of faith in British business and British manufacturing, and I've got no faith whatsoever in the EU.
Hardiman exports to 38 countries. He believes it would be even more if Britain were out of the EU and able to negotiate its own free trade agreements. Hardiman says he's utterly fed up with the parliamentary shenanigans. He'd now be happy for the UK to leave on March the 29th without an exit deal.
The great thing about no deal is the 29th, it's done. No more arguments, no more fiddling about with Parliament to try and scupper this. It's done.
And since the EU has a massive trade surplus with Britain, he doesn't believe there'll be lasting paralysis and gridlock at the ports.
There will be disruption for about a week, and it will be sorted within a week.
More than 100 miles south of the rivet factory in the heart of London, barrister Martin Howe sits in the cloistered calm of his chambers and expresses the same enthusiasm for a no-deal Brexit.
Once we leave, and if we leave without a deal, our negotiating position vis-à-vis the EU will be enormously strengthened.
Howe runs a pro-Brexit campaign group, Lawyers for Britain, which on the face of it seems a little odd since his practice involves a lot of EU cases. What is a specialist in EU law doing championing Brexit? Aren't you shooting yourself in the foot?
Well, no. I mean, the reason is because I know so much about the way European law operates, the more and more appalled I get.
He admits that without a deal, he could lose access to the European court and lose business. Indeed, dozens of British lawyers have been registering with Irish legal bodies in order to keep their access. But Howell hasn't. He remains totally committed to Brexit for the sake, he says, of British democracy.
The essential thing is to get back control over our laws and once again be a parliamentary democracy where we can chuck out, if we don't like the laws that are passed, we can chuck out the people responsible.
In his electronics factory, 80 miles south of London, another Brexiteer, Tony Barnett, also sees Brexit as a bid for freedom and democracy, and also has no fear of a no-deal exit. You would rather have a no-deal Brexit than a no-Brexit at all?
Yes, unequivocally.
Now, aged 78, Barnett built up his electronics firm from nothing into a business employing 50 people and exporting all over the world. Brexit, he says, will widen the horizons of British business. Entrepreneurs should not be afraid.
Well, we as a country in the past, we've been pretty adventurous. We need to bring some of that adventurous spirit back again.
But, he says, the spirit emanating from Parliament, from big business and from the mainstream business organisations doesn't seem adventurous at all. The prevailing mood is fearful. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I mean, aren't magicians just, like, born with these abilities?
Now you see it, now you don't. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 110 today, 0.4%, 26,026. The NASDAQ up 62 points, that's 0.8%, 75.95. The S&P 500 up 19 points, about 0.6%, 28.03. For the week, the Dow basically flat. The NASDAQ picked up 0.9%. The S&P 500, 0.4% to the plus side. Gap climbed 16.1% today. After that Old Navy announcement that Erica Barris was telling us about, Gap will be keeping a hold of Banana Republic. Ralph Lauren, right? Lauren or Loren? I get it wrong every time, you guys. Anyway, that company struck up 1.4% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not that it's necessarily any of my business, but how are you feeling out there? Anyway, a little economically glum, perhaps? I ask because the good people at the Commerce Department told us this morning that consumer spending was down about 0.6% in December, and consumer sentiment, literally how you're feeling, finished February at its second lowest level since the 2016 election. But here's the thing. The job market is strong, inflation's under control, wages are ticking up, so why all the long faces? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to figure that out.
When we saw this morning's data, we sent out an all-points bulletin on social media asking how folks are feeling. Some of you wrote back that you're worried about jobs in spite of the statistically strong job market. Stu Mark is a project manager in his early 50s who's been looking for work for well over a year.
The stock market is not the economy. GDP is not the economy. It's bad out here.
His wife is looking for work, too, and they live in a depressed area of southern New Jersey.
We're eating into the nest egg that we should have been not touching, and we have to be tight-fisted about everything.
Others of you worried about rising prices in spite of low inflationary expectations. Megan McCrae is 45, an attorney in Boston. She says she and others she knows are struggling with housing and health care costs.
I have a number of friends who are underemployed. Having a job doesn't necessarily cover health care costs.
And then there's the government shutdown. Chris Fuller is 37. As a government contractor, he lost more than a month of income permanently.
I actually had to put off a car repair and some of the home improvement projects. They just have to be scrapped altogether.
And Fuller says even though he's back at work, he's keeping a tight rein on his spending.
Especially with all of the rumors going around that there may be another recession on the horizon.
Fuller says it doesn't help that he's still shell-shocked from the last recession 10 years ago. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I say magician, and you think, what? Just a guy, because it's usually a guy, right? Just a guy on a stage or something doing some kind of illusion. Oh, get with the 21st century, will you? Because while, yes, prestidigitation is an ancient craft, in this digital age, it has become a very modern business. Ian Frisch is a journalist who wrote about magic and then became a practitioner. His new book on the industry is called Magic is Dead. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So look, far be it for me to quibble with an author about the title of his book, but magic is dead, based on my reading of this book, seems not to be right, right? It's just, it's very much alive, but different than I think what a lot of people think it is.
Yeah, I would think maybe the magic world you knew to exist is quite dead, or at least transformed quite dramatically. For a long time, you know, magic kind of operated like a monarchy. You know, if you were coming up in the scene, you still had gatekeepers and kings to impress and people to kind of usher you up to the, you know, to the top, you know, to these upper echelons. But now with social media, with the internet, with the accessibility of information, it's kind of transformed into a democracy. You know, people have their own voice and they have control over their own image.
Of which you are a good example, right? Because you did not grow up as a kid saying, "Ooh, I want to be a magician," right?
No, definitely not. Never had a kiddie magic set. My mother was a poker player growing up, so, you know, we had a little bit of deception in our blood that way. But I really wasn't into magic until 2015 when I stumbled upon Chris Ramsey, who's a main character in my book, on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at this guy, and he had a YouTube channel as well, and I'm checking him out, and I'm like, this dude does not look like a magician. You know, he was wearing, like, the latest streetwear, and he had, like, a beard and a backwards hat and all these tattoos. The current crop of young magicians, they're not only progressing the craft, but also the brand of magician, which is what got me into the story in the first place, really.
Yeah, well, we'll get to how you got into it in a second, but I do want to talk about how magicians today, and you have become now one of them, or one of you, I suppose. You got to work at it, right? It's social media, it's individual branding, it's all of that stuff that is, in a way, part of the digital age for a really old, old craft.
Right. You know, to step back and kind of give a sense about how this all kind of works is that magicians for a very long time, they had kind of shared secrets, you know, behind the scenes through self-published books or just by word of mouth, you know. Mm-hmm. But once the internet came into play as a tool that they could use, you had an explosion of entrepreneurship. People started developing online retail stores where you could develop magic tricks and then sell them. And that's where I came into it in terms of creating an effect and selling it.
In the lingo of industry, right? You guys went from a B2B enterprise, business to business enterprise, to a business to consumer enterprise. I mean, you invented a trick and you have a YouTube trailer for it, for crying out loud.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, you know, and the whole setup of this, you know, because I've reported on business, you know, as a working journalist, and I was really interested in how all these young magicians were not only using social media and the internet to kind of just put themselves out there, but they were creating these systems where these magic tricks or their new takes on perhaps older effects could be disseminated and discovered by people who are maybe just getting into magic. There's dozens of websites where everyday normal people can go online and, you know, pay 10, 15, 20 bucks and learn how to do magic tricks.
Which democratizes it. And that, I suppose, is good for y'all because it gets you out there and it gets you a new market, as it were. But do you – okay, ready? Do you worry about losing the magic of magic?
No, because I think the magic of magic is people continuing to dig into it from a practitioner's perspective. You know, you can go online and you can use YouTube and learn. You know, I think magicians, although they guard their secrets, they really enjoy when people get into magic. And I think that's why I was accepted into this world, because I showed such an intense and earnest curiosity for how this all works. I mean, aren't magicians just like born with these abilities? And, you know, that's not really the case, you know, as you can tell from my journey in this kind of underground subculture.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. It's called Magic is Dead. And spoiler alert, it's really not. The book is by Ian Frisch. Ian, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You can check out that trailer for the magic trick that Ian invented and sold. Also read about ways magicians make money. Today, it's all at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which American consumers think push-button shopping is too hard, I guess. You remember those dash buttons from a couple of years ago, Amazon dash buttons, that you thought maybe were a joke? Literally little buttons you could put on your washing machine and you'd press it when you needed to order new detergent through Amazon? Yeah, well, they're going away. Apparently, what happens is that people are just ordering on their Alexas now. Go figure that out. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 110 today, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 62 points, 0.8%. S&P 500 up 19 points, 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.